This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. Julie Daniel Davis is an advocate for technology and education. She brings her experience in edtech for K-12 to her work as a consultant, the host of a podcast on voice technology, and as an adjunct instructor on our campus, the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Julie, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here with you today, Ray.
How did you get into what we call educational technology?
It found me. I actually have a degree in accounting. After having a degree in accounting and having my children, I decided what I really wanted to do was teach accounting. And so I went back to school, got my business ed licensure to teach. And the first job that came available to me was to teach computer applications. And I literally asked the person who called me and said, "Are you sure that I'm even qualified to teach that?" Long story short, I was. I still haven't ever taught accounting, but the doors open for me to really get involved with educational technology. Years later, I got my master's degree in instructional technology from UT Chattanooga. And just as the mobile learning started happening, the world just kind of evolved into a place where I was pulled into that to help support learning in the classroom.
And all of this was before the pandemic, which has just reshaped our lives in so many ways, including technology in education.
Right. Yeah, I think in March of last year, when the pandemic hit, I was the director of instructional technology and innovation at Chattanooga Christian School at that point in time. And we went online. And so fortunately, we were a school who used technology quite a bit. So the jump wasn't that hard for most of our teachers. But all of a sudden, we're looking at how do we engage students? How do we do the things that we need to do in order to meet their needs? And so it was a step back. Okay, what's the most important things that they need to get out of this year? So there were some bare bones things that had to be done. And then there were some things where we realized, well, we could add this or we could do this to really help students flourish in this kind of environment.
It was a sharp learning curve.
It was. Definitely so for everyone involved, even for me, because I wasn't trained to support that type of learning. But as I told someone early on, I felt like a fireman must feel when they go to the biggest fire they've ever been to, and they know this is what they've been trained for. And while you never want to face that, it felt like this is it. This is what my whole life's been trained towards. So it felt, in a weird way, also very affirming in the role that I was in.
And that role, that sharp learning curve, all of that spurred you to take the direction that you are now on.
It did. The decision was already made when March came that I wasn't going to go back to CCS next year. I took an early retirement after being there for 15 years. It had nothing to do with the pandemic, really, in terms of leaving the school. But the doors opened for me to really just start looking at how can I support in a bigger role, how can I support education in the world that we are in right now? One of those things was to become a consultant and go into schools and help schools navigate this new world we were in. Another thing was I started teaching an EdTech graduate level course at UT Chattanooga, which is actually preparing graduate students who are going to be in the classroom or who are already in the classroom in using educational technology. Never before did it ever seem as relevant as it did as I started. And then lastly, I had been involved in the voice technology community for a really long time. When I say voice technology, think Alexa, Google Assistant, Bixby, Cortana, those type of things. And I've really been able to kind of focus on, my opinion, what will be the next paradigm to really impact education, voice technology. And so those are the things that have really spurred me on. I tend to be a futurist when I think about education and what is the future of education going to look like. So that's where I'm at now, and I'm really enjoying that.
You do a weekly podcast.
The podcast came from when working full time, I kind of got labeled as someone who knew how to use the Amazon Alexa in the classroom in a way that protected student privacy. So people from all over the world were reaching out to me and asking me questions. And when you're working full time, there wasn't enough me. So I would then say, hey, listen to episode number 217, and then you'll know about that part of it. And so it kind of grew from there. And I've continued to do that. It's a weekly podcast to meet the needs of teachers and educators to help them think critically about voice education. But it also is out there to help those who are developing for voice to realize what education needs in this space.
Give us a few examples of where things are heading when it comes to voice technology in education. And then as a futurist, as you have described yourself, what's beyond the horizon?
When you think voice technology, you're thinking artificial intelligence. And so that world is growing by leaps and bounds. And one of the things that concerns me in this is that there doesn't seem to be a lot of ethical standards involved with the use of these things. So one of the things I want to do is speak into that space so that it won't just happen to education or to the world for that matter. So one of the things that I see now, or some of the things that we see now, are teachers using like the Amazon Alexa or the Google Assistant in the classroom to help them almost like a teacher assistant. So think of it like it's in the back of the classroom. There's a small group working around that assistant to do some skill or action using that device. So maybe it's they've got a homework page and they're checking their math problems to see if they got it right. But it's also an efficiency in the classroom for a teacher. A teacher can set reminders, routines. They can create a flash briefing, which is like a daily or weekly news brief that they could send out to parents, or if it were sitting in the back of the room, even for students, like, you know, okay, it's a flash briefing for your language arts. And so it tells the students what they need to know for that day in order to get the learning started. So what does the future look like? I think what we'll see is more and more voice interacting on top of platforms we already use in education. So you're going to see one of the fastest growing learning management systems is Canvas. Canvas is something that most recently Amazon Alexa came out, and I can set up a skill on my Amazon Alexa to tell me what's on my to-do list in Canvas. So things that really helps teachers and students move forward in a way that just helps them with the daily routines of life. I believe the future as a whole in education is going to be predictive and personalized. Predictive meaning things like voice assistants out there that is going to predict the next question that you might have and be able to answer that question without more, more prompting. And personalized meaning we're in a day and age with the amount of technology that is out there that we don't have to teach to the masses anymore. We don't have to teach all 30 students the exact same way and wonder or know as a teacher, those 10 got it, those 10 didn't, and these in the middle are okay. And so by personalization, I can use a device like a voice assistant to create something that fills the gaps just for a certain student or a group of students. So I can create a program for that to happen. And I think that's going to be the future. We're going to see this type of thing. Voice is the natural way we communicate already. For a student who's a non-reader, this is a perfect way to meet that need without needing another teacher in the classroom.
Another piece of this is bridging the digital divide.
Right. Equity is a huge issue in the haves and have-nots of technology and access to technology. We happen to live in a city that's doing a really good job of trying to fill those gaps, but that's not the case everywhere. And so one of the things that I really do love about a voice assistant is that you're talking about a device that costs $80 or less. And if I put it in a classroom, I actually have the ability to meet everybody in that classroom with that device because it's communal in nature. So everyone has access to it, unlike a laptop where two or three can sit around at one time. And then the other upside to this is when you look at the immersion rates of the number of households that have a smartphone in their home, it's like in the 90s. And you can download the Amazon Alexa app or the Google Assistant app for free, and you don't have to even have that device in order to use some of its functions. So really, if a teacher wanted to create things, a family wouldn't necessarily even have to have the device. So I think that kind of answers some of those equity issues as well.
What are some misconceptions that people have when it comes to educational technology, voice technology? Whether we're talking about educators who may have those misconceptions or families.
Being in this role for as long as I've been in, it feels like a place where you're often battered because there's a lot of pushback in technology and education. And a lot of it comes from fear. Fear that teachers feel like they may be replaced one day. There's a teacher perspective. Parents feel like that's too much screen time for my child or interaction with technology for my child. And then there's always privacy concerns with any of this technology, but especially voice technology. I mean, we've seen lots of things in the news that just makes it hard for Amazon and Google to get over that bad rep of privacy issues. And those are things as we move forward as educators or as a world, especially in this day and time of pandemic, we're going to have to really answer the privacy issues. And I think edtech companies as a whole are really going to have to answer those very well. And I will say, voice technology, the Alexa and the Google Assistant, they don't see themselves as educational technology. They see themselves as a consumer-driven tool. And so we are adjusting based on setting up certain safeguards, adjusting that to be used in a different role. But when you look at edtech in general, there's very little edtech out there that actually was created, technology that was created for education. The only thing I can really think about are maybe the interactive whiteboards and the clickers, the remote control clickers where you used to like get to choose which question to like a quiz type thing. But for the most part, Chromebooks weren't, iPads weren't, all these things were created and then adapted and adopted by education. So I think that's part of the reason we see that hesitancy, because oftentimes people see it in a different role and don't see it for educational purposes. And they just need to be, for lack of a better word, educated on the benefits of using educational technology to meet needs.
Another thing that we're more mindful of now, after a year of the pandemic and so many of us relying on the virtual space to live and to work, is there comes a point where you've got to unplug. Nobody can be in the virtual space 24/7. We were not built to live or work that way. So somebody such as yourself doing what you do, how do you unplug? And somebody who is also a mother with children, how do you make sure that they unplug?
Right. I think the first thing I would say is, as an educator, I think it's really important that all educators be teaching digital citizenship. And one of those tenets is learning that balance. And so we're speaking into that space as educators saying, hey, guys, you can't just stay on it all the time. It's unhealthy to stay on it all the time. And while it might be fun, there's other things out there that are fun and easy to do and will be just as rewarding. So I think parents have to set limits. And the younger you start, the better. It's a lot easier to set a limit on a six-year-old and then work up than it is to start creating limits with a 15-year-old with a cell phone and expect them to want to accept those limits. So I think parents have to set limits. For myself, I actually have apps on my phone that monitor how much time am I using this device. And I get a weekly report and I'm like, sometimes I look at it and go, whoa, I need to back off on this area, or I'm obviously spending too much time here. So a self-awareness, I think, is important. But for children, you as a parent you're going to have to help them learn how to be self-aware. And then look for ways as a family to disconnect completely. One of my favorite things to do is hike the Chattanooga area. And so I go out on hikes and my phone doesn't always work in areas where I'm hiking. And I love those moments because it allows me to not feel guilty about being away from my phone or being disconnected. And I think it's important that we each find our way that we can disconnect, but also in a way that brings us joy. Because if it doesn't spark joy, we're not going to be willing to give it up.
As long as we don't throw anybody out of balance in how much time that they are online, to keep up on all that you do, where can they go?
Yeah, good point. I have a website, www.juliedavisedu.com. That's more for people who are looking for an educational consultant type thing. I'm very active on Twitter at juliedavisedu. And if you want to shoot me an email, you can send it to juliedavisedu@gmail.com. Basically, if you say juliedavisedu, you're probably going to find me.
All right. Julie, thanks so much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
On Thursday and Friday, the Chattanooga Symphony and Opera presents its Elgar String Serenade. The performances begin at 7 p.m. at First Cumberland Presbyterian. Kayoko Dan is the CSO's music director.
We're performing four works, and one of them is Edward Elgar's Serenade for Strings, E minor, opus 20. This was written in his early 30s, but he actually started writing before he became a famous composer. So there are a lot of charm, like youthful charm to it. The second movement is absolutely stunning. There are three movements, and then there's so much charm and excitement and energy to it. And I'm really excited to perform this work. Another work for the string orchestra is Jonathan McNair. You all know him, right? Professor at UTC. We have collaborated many times. We're performing a work written by him called These Three. And this was originally written for a string quartet as a memory of Chattanooga urban designer named Christian Rushing. When I reached out to him a couple months ago, like, I need some ideas for a socially distanced work for this season. And he said, well, this is relatively recent music, and I wrote it for quartet, but you can also play as a string orchestra. And he rewrote it, you know, added some parts and stuff like that. So it reflects this urban designer's life, his personality, and it's very charming and exciting and lots of hope and beauty. So that's going to be a first for us.
An urban designer here in Chattanooga who helped shape Chattanooga today.
Right. Yeah. So I think it reflects the energy of Chattanooga, the people and the beauty and hope and just energy of the whole city itself. And other two pieces are, one of them is Dindy's a sextet for flute, oboe, two clarinets, horn, and two bassoons. It's called Chanson and Dance and has two movements. It's very elegant and charming and has lots of lush harmonies, even with just like six people or seven people. Brilliant and written French piece. And another one is a fun piece by composer and percussionist named Brett Deeds. He wrote a piece for his students, I believe, for two percussionists. They said, hey, I need another piece for this duo recital. And he just like, all right. And it took him 2-3 days to write this piece. And it's called Street Fight because he said the energy is like really intense and exciting. And it felt like it was two guys fighting on the street. But we will be socially distanced. So it will be a distance street fighting.
Tell us more about the venue for this kind of socially distanced event.
We have been very fortunate that we've had many venues that welcomed us this season. And we are performing this program at First Cumberland Presbyterian Church. And we have been all over the city, the First Baptist, the Basilica. We've been to Ooltewah, Collegedale. We've been everywhere. And we're just so fortunate that the community is embracing us since the city has shut down Tivoli. And it's been a wonderful opportunity to be out in the community more than we are used to.
And have you performed in that space before?
We performed there in the fall, and it's a wonderful, beautiful space. Acoustic is just amazing. Even with the small force, the sound is so vibrant that it feels very full.
And you've been with the CSO here in Chattanooga for nearly a decade.
Yes, it was 2011 that I came. So this will be my 10th season.
You are from Japan, and you started learning music at the age of 3.
Right. I mean, it sounds impressive, but it wasn't. It was basically my friend who was 2 years older than me, who I adored and admired. You know, she started playing piano, and I wanted to do everything she was doing. So that's why I said, I want to be in the piano class, you know, that she's going to. So that sparked the love of music. So the initial interest wasn't that music attracted me. It's just like, I wanted to be just like a friend. And then once I got there, it just hooked me for life.
And then you came to this country and you have a background in other cities, other venues, and a background that includes orchestra, ballet, and opera.
Right. Yeah. Well, they all kind of come together in a way. As an orchestral conductor, you have an opportunity to accompany ballet companies, especially Nutcracker. It's such a nice collaboration. That Nutcracker was actually my first professional gig back in 2004 with the Phoenix Symphony in Ballet Arizona. So it has a very special place in my heart. And as an orchestral conductor, you have an opportunity to conduct opera every so often. I'm not as experienced as my predecessor, Bob Barnhart, but yeah, I've dabbled in it. But I think I feel most comfortable in myself in front of an orchestra.
You are passionate about music education.
So my initial plan for myself being a music major was to become a teacher. I wanted to be a high school band director. But along the way, I fell in love with orchestra music during college. So I decided that I will pursue this. And I got my second degree, master's in music education as well. And I got my doctorate degree thinking that, oh, if I have a doctorate degree, I can teach out of college. So, you know, one thing leads to another with the Nutcracker and Phoenix Symphony, just that professional world door opened. And when that opens, you just walk through it. And I always consider myself an educator first. So that's been my foundation of who I am. But by pursuing that, it gave me this opportunity. So I'm very grateful for that.
And how do you see music education going forward as we emerge sooner, hopefully, rather than later from this pandemic?
I think music education and just education in general is like the most important thing that we can invest in right now, because they are the future. They are going to keep the arts alive. I know that for sure for me, without music, I wouldn't be where I am today in terms of my personal development. I'm a very introverted person. I was a very shy person. For me to be able to stand in front of people, thousands of people, and do what I do is all because of the opportunity I got as in music. And I know there are so many children out there who could benefit from being exposed to music and being involved in something like this, something greater than themselves, and be able to have a safe space to express themselves. So to me, I think it's a very vital element of our society right now.
And for more information about the CSO and about this concert, where can people go online?
www.chattanoogasymphony.org.
All right. Kayoko, thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots. This afternoon from Barking Legs, we have guitarist and singer Jimmy Galloway, who studied music and recording at UNC Chapel Hill under electronic music visionary Dr. Robert Moog. He's been influenced equally by Chet Atkins and Mark Knopfler, as you can hear in his fingerstyle guitar playing, a mix of folk-based Americana roots rock, little bit of fusion, psychedelia, and the ambient work of some 20th century avant-garde composers. He lives on Signal Mountain and teaches guitar at the Mountain Arts Community Center. Video of this performance at Barking Legs is on the Wednesday Jazz at Barking Legs Facebook page. On Scenic Roots, this is Jimmy Galloway. Thank you.
yonder. I've been bit off ten. Monday morning, got them hangover blues. I got a job, but it don't pay much. Every time I pick up that guitar, seem like I lost my touch. Monday morning, got them hangover blues. Hang on blues, hang on blues. Hang on blues, hang on blues. Monday morning, got him hang on the blues. She may be mad, gonna find out she's the best thing I ever had. Monday morning, got them hangover blues. I pay my bills, but then I pay my rent. Come Monday morning, I'm where that money went. Monday morning, got them hangover blues. Just go walking off these hangover blues. Just go walking off these hangover blues. Just go walking off these hangover and comes down so hard. When it comes down, and it comes down so high. Little things I'm touching, an old familiar saying, as though I've been wandering through the fog and the rain. Changes coming, half-hearted refrains. There's a cloud up above me. Get used to the pain.
Oh, now. was Trout Town. And this one, Remember Me. It's off my first self-titled record. Play into the interwebs.
Just to make it through another day. You've been working late, and I've been working early to see you for a minute. Reminds me of a time. Remember how we met. Remember, I wanted you. Remember what we've seen. Now it's just a strain to keep our voices low. And 90 miles ain't nothing that we do a minute. Hush, let me hold on to what we knew before.
Remember, remember.
Time in the fall when the leaves were falling, piles of red and orange throughout the yard. I ran just as hard as a child with a ghost behind him. Leapt into the air and made the earth in me. How's that? I know we pay a little as we go. Focus on the tree line. Things come to us in this life if only for a short time. In the rearview mirror, it's too late for you. Say goodbye. 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 Thank you.
In my soul, in a time I just as soon forget. There's a brightness in your eyes, and a light I sure I'll never get. You've got a certain way, when you're around, everything just clicks. Some days the house is falling down, and all I got left are the sticks. Never seemed like a good idea until you came around. Your name's ringing in my ear. Now you get used to the sound. One foot to the fire, one to lift me higher, and just take the next step. I'm blue eyes on the highway, red eyes looking back. I ain't got time for that. Something watching out for me, keeping me on track. I'm going to the fire, want to lift me higher, just take the next step. Blue eyes on the highway, red eyes looking back. I ain't got time for that. Blue eyes on the highway, red eyes looking back. Ain't got time for that. I ain't got time for that.
All right. That was 1 foot, and Tree Line was before that one.
Jimmy Galloway, Embarking Legs, for the Wednesday Jazz at Barking Legs series of virtual shows on their Facebook page. The full set with video is on the Wednesday Jazz at Barking Legs Facebook page. We'll have the second half of his set here on Scenic Roots next Tuesday afternoon on listener-supported public radio.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.